and welcome back to another episode of The Good Stuff, a podcast for the Irish non-profit community brought to you by The Wheel. I'm Emily Burke, and this is the final episode of our three-part series about language and the non-profit sector. In the first episode, we talked about why exactly words matter, and the many different words that exist to talk about non-profit organisations. Then, in the second episode, we focused on keeping it simple and saying what you mean, focusing on the benefits of plain English for non-profits. If you haven't had a chance to listen, just go to wheel.ie/podcasts and look for Series 3, Episodes 1 and 2. To round out our exploration of language, today we're going to talk about empathy. Many of us in the non-profit community work on behalf of other people, and few would contest the importance of keeping them at the centre of our work at all times. But although we're always working with this goal in mind, it can be a challenge to make sure that our language always reflects this reality. In the second half of this episode, we'll be speaking with Laura Murphy, a poet, activist, campaigner, and communication strategist. Laura is an outspoken advocate for survivors of mother and baby homes in Ireland, and I reached out to her as the reception of the recent Mother and Baby Homes report has brought the question of empathy and language to the forefront of public discourse in recent months. She provides a powerful account of how language can affect those on whose behalf we speak. But first, we're joined by public affairs consultant Kathleen O'Mara. Kathleen has a long history in media and politics, as well as in the non-profit sector, and she explains why it's vital to keep empathy at the centre of our work and give some advice on how we can go about it as well.
My name is Kathleen O'Mara. I'm a public affairs and communications consultant now and have been since last June 2020. But before that, I started out originally as a journalist, but I couldn't get a job as a journalist in the 80s. I went to work for the Labour Party in their press office, but then I went to work for RTE. But the pull of the whole political world pulled me back, and I was offered a job as an advisor to Ethna Fitzgerald in the 90s. And I went to work as Ethna's advisor. I loved that. And directly from that, I decided that I wanted to be a politician myself. I was a member of the Senate. I was a member of the Shannon, which was just fantastic. I loved it. But in 2007, I decided to move on. And I had realised about myself that I was more of a campaigner. And so I went to work for the Irish Cancer Society as their first head of advocacy and communications. And that was my first direct experience of the not-for-profit sector. And from there in 2016, I went to work for the Rehab Group in a similar role in advocacy and communications. But last year, in fact, before the pandemic, I had decided that I wanted to set up on my own, and I wanted to work purely in public affairs and communications. So that's what I'm doing now.
I asked Kathleen what she thinks our responsibilities are as nonprofits when it comes to language and communication.
Well, I think the not-for-profit sector, including charities, have a considerable responsibility when it comes to the language they use. And that's because we, as not-for-profits, we have a responsibility to ensure that the cause we stand for is reflected in the language we use, in the tone of the language we use, in the words we use. So Michael D. Higgins, for instance, I was at an event that he spoke at when I was in the Irish Cancer Society, and I was very struck by something he said. He called on us all there. He called on us to use the language of the heart. And it struck me very strongly that we weren't using the language of the heart. And it is something that I had seen. We use institutionalized language. We use jargon. So, for instance, say in the disability world, we use a sentence like service users located in congregated settings. Now, firstly, what does that mean? And secondly, what labels are we using about people? So I have a particular issue with the use of service users to describe people, but particularly to describe vulnerable people. It's like a label that we put on their forehead. They are the people who use our services. And that might take a little bit longer to say, but that's the language that we must be using because we are talking about people. It's very, very important if in the sector that you are speaking on behalf of vulnerable people, you are their voice. So what language are you using to be their voice? Are you using language that they would never use, that they mightn't even understand, words which are like a foreign language to them? If you're doing that, I would suggest you're not getting it right. You need to think about the language that people who are vulnerable would use themselves, either about themselves or want used to describe them or to speak about them. Like, it's a big responsibility to carry to speak on behalf of people or even to speak on behalf of a group of people. And if you're in that role, it's very, very important to really listen to the words you use and not to fall into the jargon of the system, for want of a better word. You know, it's very noticeable, I think, that people who work in, say, for instance, parts of the health sector, and I noticed this when I worked in the disability sector, that the language of the institution, of the HSE as an institution, was adopted or has been adopted by people who work with people who have a disability, particularly as they, you know, if they're in a management role. And you can say it's a handy shorthand. You know, when you're at meetings, you talk about, everybody knows what congregated settings is. But I don't think that's acceptable, actually, because you're still there speaking on behalf of the people who are using your service. So therefore, you have a responsibility to ensure that the language you're speaking about them is appropriate, is accurate, and is fully representing them authentically.
I also asked if she could share an example of this principle in action.
Absolutely. When I worked for the Irish Cancer Society, we had a big debate internally about the use of the language of survivor, fighting cancer, for instance, the battle against cancer. And so we had a big debate about that, you know, whether it was appropriate at all to use that language. It really worked, I think, from a fundraising point of view, the notion of mobilising people in the battle against cancer. Let's get this and let's overcome. But what we did then was we sat down with people who had cancer or who had, you know, who had come through a cancer journey and asked them what was the language that worked for them. And that's the place to go to the people themselves and ask the people themselves, what is the language that works for them? What's more appropriate for them? And there's no doubt some people who do like to refer themselves as in a fight against cancer or in a battle against cancer. But for many others, it doesn't work because, you know, it suggests that if you don't come through, that you have somehow lost or that maybe you have failed. And that's not appropriate at all, you know, in this particular context. So that to me was a very, very powerful and very important conversation to have. But the most important part of it was that we went to the source and we went to speak and listen to and hear the voices of the people who, you know, we and I was one of them who was going out into the public domain to speak on their behalf. So it was very, very important. And I had to take full responsibility for the language we were using and to ensure that it was appropriate, it was authentic, and it was language that they were comfortable with and they had effectively approved of.
But are there ever tensions between the language of successful fundraising and the language of empathy?
OK, if you take the world of cancer and, you know, you the fundraiser, you think that the language of fighting cancer and getting cancer, you know, getting ahead and all that, that that's going to work better than or more effectively than the voice of the person who has either had cancer or has cared for somebody who's had cancer or has, you know, come through cancer themselves. I don't necessarily agree that that would be the case. Personally, I think the authentic voice is the most powerful voice. So if you look at somebody like Vicky Phelan, we are hearing her authentic voice, her personal story. And in my experience, the personal story is the most powerful place to come from, including for fundraising. That there doesn't have to be that tension between the authentic voice of the person you're speaking for. You know, there doesn't have to be that tension between that and the demand of fundraising. I think, you know, and there is a place where they can be aligned. And I think from the perspective of the organisation, and just to get back to like the language of the heart and the authentic voice of the organisation, surely the authentic voice of the organisation is the authentic voice of the person that the organisation exists to serve. It's an interesting one because I think we organisations get sucked into, particularly with funding proposals or pitches or whatever, that there's a certain language that has to be used. It's almost like a different language. it's like a foreign language, but you have to use those terms, you know, that the system somehow recognises. See, I'd be, the campaigner in me comes out on that, because I'd be saying, no, actually, I'm not going to give in to that. I'm going to use the authentic language here. And I'll make my at least my stand for that. I mean, it is a challenge. There's no question about it. I totally agree. It's a challenge, particularly with funding proposals, or, you know, with a donor who you've decided, or you know, needs to or wants to be spoken to in a particular way, or wants, you know, certain descriptions to be used. But I think the question you would ask yourself is that the most powerful way to do this? You know, is it really the most powerful way to do this? And where is the voice of the people we represent? You know, and how, I mean, from my experience, making the case for funding for something is more powerful when it's spoken from or written from the authentic voice of the cause that's at the heart of the organisation that's making that proposal. So I'd say don't compromise and don't take the shortcut and don't be lazy.
What risks do we take when we don't use the language of empathy?
Oh, well, I think the key risk we run when we don't do that is dehumanising people. That's the key. And I think that we're not in touch with the heart. You know, I don't want to say we'd get hard-hearted. I don't think we would. But, you know, in the race to be effective, I suppose, and to maybe use the shortcut, that's why I felt that the reminder by the president to us as a sector to speak the language of the heart was so important. Because it's so easy not to. It's so easy to just fall into that habit and that jargon and that shorthand, you know, and that kind of what appears to be effective, you know, in-house language. But to remember that in doing that, we run the risk of dehumanising the people who we speak about, and, you know, and whether they're children or vulnerable or, you know, our adults who are vulnerable. We risk dehumanising them. We risk creating a distance between ourselves and them, and then creating a distance between them and the broader world, whether they be funders, you know, the institutions we're meeting, supporters, or whoever they are. So it's really important to always work to keep the heart-centered piece present, to keep the language of the heart present, and remind ourselves why that is, because we do run the risk of, like, losing our authentic voice. And I think then losing, you know, the power we have to speak on behalf of people, and the right we have to speak on behalf of people as well.
Finally, I asked for Kathleen's top tips for putting this advice into practice.
Yes, I think you should, if you're writing something or speaking something, speak it out loud first and listen to the words you're using. Think of the audience. Think of the person, you know, the cause at the heart of your charity, like maybe children. It may be people with disability, maybe adults who are vulnerable. Will they understand it? Will they get it? What will they hear? How will they hear it? Where is it coming from? Is it coming from your head? Or is there any part of your heart there at all? And look at the words you're using. Are they words you'd use with your best friend? Now, your best friend who doesn't work in the sector, right? So are they words you would use, you know, in a conversation with your mother on the phone on a Sunday to catch up when she says, how's it going at work? Are they words that you would use? Is it understandable to a 9-year-old? Because the average reading age of the population is actually 9. So is it understandable to a 9-year-old? Is it located in a story? I would ask as well. Are you speaking a story? Are you creating a story? Or are you just going blah, 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 blah? Really listen. Really listen. And try it out on people. And ask them what they hear. And spend a bit of time at it. Like, you know, the shortcuts. Yeah, we all take shortcuts from time to time. But, you know, teach yourself another shortcut. Teach yourself another way of doing it. Yeah. And ask yourself the most important question, am I using the language of the heart?
Listening to Kathleen's insights about the language of the heart, I couldn't but reflect on an issue that has been prominent in the Irish media for some time now. In January of 2021, the the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes published its final report, detailing the results of its inquiry into the institutions. I'm assuming that listeners have some level of familiarity with the topic. If not, I would recommend reading some news coverage before listening to the rest of this episode. Following the release of the report, SHANAD leader Regina Doherty said that it would be wrong for the government to accept it. Speaking about the women involved, she said, and I quote, "This report does a huge disservice to treat them with language that's so callous and as cold and completely lacks in empathy." She called for, and I quote again, "a document that actually acknowledges with empathy, with care, with understanding, the real lived experiences of these women." It's a particularly poignant example of how vital empathy is when speaking on behalf of other people. And Laura Murphy very kindly took the time to talk with me about the impact of the report from the perspective of mother and baby home survivors.
My name is Laura Murphy. I am the daughter of a mother and baby home survivor. I recently wrote an open letter to An Taoiseach asking him to retract the section in the state apology that disperses blame onto society, the family and the fathers of the children. The letter went viral, basically. It was covered by media outlets internationally, locally, nationally. It's garnered unprecedented support from celebrities, politicians and survivors. So I suppose one of the main pieces of feedback I get is about the empathy within the letter. And survivors of all, you know, there are many survivors to this stories. You know, it's the mothers, it's the children, it's the families, it's the second generation survivors. And many of them have come back to say, "I needed this letter at this time because I couldn't articulate what the state apology has done to me, only to say that it's causing me severe pain." You know, these people are closer to the trauma than I have been. And so that gave me a unique position to be able to understand it, but also to be able to speak it with empathy and articulate what so many of us in this country were feeling. So that's why I'm very glad to have this opportunity to speak about the importance of empathy around the whole thing.
I asked for Laura's perspective on the language in the report that has been described as cold and callous.
Like many people, I haven't been able to read the full report. I haven't been able to read the full executive summary. I have done as much as I can, and what I did read was a complete re-traumatization again. I mean, I'm a second generation survivor. It was still very hard for me to read, and the language is just really juvenile, unprofessional, it's misleading, but more importantly, it invalidates the experience of the survivors, and it has a tone of condoning the state and the condoning the behaviour. There was a phrase in it: "There can be no doubt that legal adoption was vastly better outcome than the alternatives previously available." Now, I know from listening to many survivors that there was significant abuse right through their childhood. Now, that's not to say there are many adoptions that were really successful and loving and were a shining light and a bright light within this whole system. But there were also many that caused and compounded trauma. And to say that there was no doubt that legal adoption was better, if you're going to make a statement that definitive, please back it up with data. They had the data in the form of survivor testimony that was not listened to, not included, and subsequently discarded. I just find myself even getting very heated as I speak about that one point. And that's, there's even more heartbreaking points. There's another one that says, "The very high rate of infant mortality in Irish mother and baby homes is probably the most disquieting feature of these institutions." In Bessborough in 1943, there was an 82% infant mortality rate versus 7% in the country. 9,000 babies that we know of died. To say and to put the language around that, that it's probably the most disquieting feature, to me, this is a heinous crime against humanity. So to put that language around this most darkest aspect of the whole thing is is beyond invalidating and it's beyond untruthful. It's a complete re-traumatization. Another one was, it says that some of the institutions were in very poor physical condition. And then it says, you know, well, it's okay because the living conditions in Ireland were generally very bad. It says living conditions in Irish homes were generally poor before the 1960s. And then they mention Kilrush and Tuam as having appalling conditions. But then they say conditions in other mother and baby homes were considered better and improved over time. In particular, conditions in Dunboyne were very good. The commission has not seen any evidence of major shortcomings in the homes that were operating in the 1970s to 1990s. So in their immediate rush to try and present, you know, a good picture of how things have improved and using juvenile language like conditions in Dunboyne were very good, they completely omitted a really, really important aspect of what was the worst that we know of. And it's been documented in letters and in the media of the time and in HSE correspondence that the situation in Bessborough was dire. And that's not even mentioned in the executive summary. But what is mentioned is that Dunboyne, the conditions in Dunboyne were very good. So there are more, you know, the use of the word illegitimate. They continually use the word illegitimate and legitimate to define babies who were born within wedlock or out of wedlock. Like the word, even in the state apology, the Taoiseach said, sorry for using this title that was a legal title put on human beings in our country that delegitimizes their humanity. But in the report, they saw fit to use this term to make differentiation between the babies. So imagine if you are one who was born out of wedlock or you were a mother who had a child who was illegitimate in quote unquote. Reading this in the report that should have been, you know, an expounding of truth and healing is just a complete re-traumatization.
From her perspective, a fundamental problem is that the voices of the women at the heart of the report are not being heard.
Yeah, like, I mean, if you're working on any strategy, you know, me and my own work in communications and marketing, you don't generate a report or you don't build a strategy without first consulting your stakeholders to get an understanding of the context, to get an understanding of the truth from their perspective. And that is data. That's the data you need to compile your understanding of what has happened. In this case, survivor testimony was gathered in good faith by the survivors and they all came courageously forward. But their testimony wasn't listened to. It was misrepresented in many cases. It was discarded. The Minister for Children now talks of his solutions being survivor centred and all the rest of it. And that's all very fine and fluffy and abstract. But it comes back to the fundamental human value of empathy. Where was the survivor centredness or the person centredness in the generation of this report? So and the survivors and the stakeholders of this scandal are survivors primarily, but they're also the second generation survivors. They're also the midwives who had to deliver these babies, who saw mothers being mistreated and tortured by the nuns, who felt helpless, many of whom have contacted me to say, only now can I cry and understand what my tears are about. The amount of women I saw being abused in childbirth, you know, where is their testimony? Where is the testimony of the guards and the priests that told women and children, you know, told the parents of women and children to get out of the parish, as was the case in my mother's situation? Many priests and guards didn't want to do that. Many, you know, thought they were doing it in the best interest of everyone because of this dogma of shame and fear that came down from the Catholic Church. So all of that evidence should have been gathered in order to give proper context and understanding.
How, in her opinion, might we better centre the voices of survivors?
It's very basic and fundamental. Treat them as human beings. These are human beings who are after enduring significant trauma through their lives. To just treat them as human beings listen to their story. When a person feels listened to, healing happens just within the act of listening, because it validates their humanity. It shows compassion. And listening has the function of healing in the moment, but it also has the function of being able to reflect the truth in the report and to the wider society so that appropriate action can be taken. In person-centered counselling, the whole model revolves around three core guiding principles, three human core values, and they are of congruence and genuineness, positive self-regard for the person, and empathy with no judgment. If a model can be built around listening to the survivor's stories with those core values only, it's not complicated, it's very simple, then we can have healing, and then we can have truth and some form of resolution for the survivors. And to show respect, I mean, the way that this report was presented, you know, a big, massive document that experts couldn't even get through, academics are finding it hard to get through. These are people trying to process trauma on a daily basis. You know, I'm not directly connected to the trauma. I'm a second generation survivor. I still wasn't. I can't imagine how it must have felt, you know, to just present it with language that reflects the enormity of what happened. Very simple language that can be understood by everybody, that makes the points potent and salient, and that the report is disseminated with care. Like, the survivors should be considered as the primary audience of this. If I was publishing a book, I publish a book with huge empathy for my end reader and understanding of my end reader. The most important end reader in this case is the survivors. Secondly, are the people who can now make the appropriate changes to rectify in some way what happens. But that wasn't the case with this report. And then lastly, to take action based on the report. You know, many politicians, including those in government, Regina Doherty and Sinn Féin, she's the leader of the Seanad, many of them are calling, Catherine Connolly, TD, Holly Kearns, are calling for an independent investigation of what happened. Empathy is probably the most important basic human value that we have in our personal lives and in the collective. And if there was one thing, one message I would deliver to my fellow Irish citizens, the government, and anyone involved or interested in this scandal in Irish history, is just focus on empathy. Focus on how you can understand the feelings of these survivors and women and children without getting absorbed and consumed by it, because it's a very hard thing to hold. But to just, if you understand and can listen to them, that in itself has profound healing for people that are being deeply re-traumatized again.
I want to thank Laura and Kathleen again for their contributions. These conversations happened completely independently from one another, and yet from two very different perspectives came one clear message. If we're to do right by other people, we must never lose sight of empathy. We must speak with people before we can speak for people, and in advocating for others, we must respect how people wish to talk about themselves. As always, we welcome questions, comments, and feedback from you, our listeners in the nonprofit community. You can find us on Twitter at @the_wheel_IRL, on Facebook as The Wheel Ireland, or you can email me at emily@wheel.ie. This brings us to the end of our focus on language, but we hope you'll join us soon for another series of The Good Stuff. Thanks for listening, and take care.